The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers.
I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work.
If you're dealing with someone who's depressed and they're really depressed, you should try giving them antidepressants. Because if they die, you can't help them. Okay, so if you're suffering, you are obligated, in a sense, to hold on to whatever rope someone throws you. And one of the things I do with my clients all the time, especially if they're really in trouble, is to tell them, look, I don't know exactly what's going to help you, but don't arbitrarily throw out any possibilities because you might not have that luxury. Antidepressants help a lot of people, and there are technical reasons why that's the case. So that's a simple answer. It's not relevant to what I already described, except that if you're offered a gift by your society and it works, try it. I don't care what your presuppositions are. Apart from that, lots of the time you see people who are suffering with depression, for example. There's a multitude of reasons, but I'll take one common reason. You can think about it as associated with the story of Peter Pan. Now, Peter Pan is someone who won't grow up, right? Now, the problem with Peter Pan is he gets to be king, but it's king of Neverland. Neverland doesn't exist. So being king of nothing isn't that helpful. Well, one of the things that you often see with people who suffer from depression, and I'm not making a blanket statement about the cause of depression because there's lots of them, is that people who don't have enough order in their life tend to get overwhelmed. So, for example, if someone comes into me and see me and they say they're depressed, I always ask them a very standard set of questions. Do you have a job? If you don't have a job, you're really in trouble in our society. First of all, your biological rhythms tend to go off the rails right away because there's no reason to go to bed at any particular time and there's no reason to get up. And for many people, if they don't get up at the same time, they follow up the functioning of their circadian rhythms, and that's enough to make them depressed right off the bat, especially if they start napping during the afternoon. They also don't have a purpose. People aren't good without a purpose. And this isn't hypothesizing. We absolutely understand the circuitry that underlies positive emotion. We know how it works. Almost all the positive emotion that any of you are likely to experience in your life will not be a consequence of attaining things. It will be a consequence of seeing that things are working as you proceed towards a goal you value. That's completely different. And you need to know this because people are often stunned, for example. They finish their PhD thesis and their presupposition is that they're going to be elated for a month. And often instead they're actually depressed and they think, what the hell? I've been working on this for 7 years and I handed it in and what do I do now? And that's what depresses them, right? It's the what do I do now? Well, they're fine if they enjoyed it pursuing the thing. As long as it was working out, they get a lot of enthusiasm and excitement out of that because that's how our nervous systems work. Most of your positive emotion is goal pursuit emotion. If you take drugs like cocaine or amphetamine, the reason they're enjoyable is because they turn on the systems that help you pursue goals. That's why people like them. So if you don't have a job, you got no structure, that's not good. Plus, you tend not to have a point. So you're overwhelmed by chaotic lack of structure and you don't have any positive emotion. Well, do you have any friends? So sometimes you see people who are depressed, they have no job, they have no friends, they have no intimate relationship, they have an additional health problem, and they have a drug and alcohol problem. My experience has been if you have three of those problems, it's almost impossible to help you. You're so deeply mired in chaos that you can't get out because you make progress on one front and one of the other problems pulls you down. So one of the things I tell people who are depressed is like, don't sacrifice your stability. Get a job, even if it's not the job you exactly want. Get a damn job, you need a job. Find some friends. Get out in the dating circuit. See if you can establish an intimate relationship. Put together some of the foundational items that are like pillars that your life rests on. Well, that's the practical thing to do. So that's one example with regards to depression. Well, the thing is, you don't just launch it on them, you know. You got to negotiate with the person. And you also got to teach them to negotiate with themselves. And this is something that's very useful to know. You know, you can tyrannize yourself into doing things, but I wouldn't recommend it. What I would recommend instead is that you ask yourself what you're willing to do. It's a really effective technique. It's like a meditative technique. So, for example, you can get up in the morning and you can think, well, you know, I'd like to have a good day today, so I'd like to go to bed tonight without feeling guilty because I, you know, didn't do some things I said I was going to do, and I, you know, I'd like to have kind of an interesting day. So you've got to fulfill my responsibilities and I want to, you know, enjoy the day. Then you can ask yourself, well, okay, what would I have to do in order for that to happen that I would do? And the probability, if you practice this for 3 or 4 days, is your brain will just tell you. It'll say, well, you know, there's that piece of homework that you haven't done for like 3 weeks. You should knock that sucker off because it would only take you 10 minutes and you've been avoiding it and torturing yourself to death for, you know, like 72 hours straight. And if you do that, here's a little interesting thing you can do. And, you know, maybe this is a little obligation you should clean up. And so what you do in a situation like that is you teach the person to negotiate with themselves. Say, well, let's figure out what your aims are. You've got to have some aims. Whatever they are. And they might say, well, I'm so depressed I don't have any aims. And then I say, well, pick the least objectionable of the aims and act it out for a while and see what happens. Because sometimes your emotional systems are so fouled up that you have to pretend, you have to act the thing out before you can start to believe it. I mean, people always assume they have to believe and then act, but that's sometimes that's true and lots of times it isn't. So the trick, if you're doing therapeutic work with somebody and you're helping them establish a structure, is to find out what they'll do. Now, if they want to get better, which is not a given, because there are often payoffs for not getting better, that's basically the payoffs of being a martyr, or maybe the payoffs of doing what your entirely pathological family members want you to do because they actually want you to fail. Assuming you want to get better, there's usually something you can figure out that would constitute a step towards some sort of concrete goal. And my presumption, it's a behavioral presumption fundamentally, is that small accruing gains that repeat are unbelievably powerful. So, you know, this is another thing to know about in your own life. It's something I learned in part from reading the writings of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who's a great Russian philosopher and novelist. You know, he said, you can look at your life and you can see what isn't right about it. I mean, all you have to do is look. And then you can start to fix that. And the way you fix it is by noticing what you could, in fact, fix. You know, people are often trying to fix things they can't fix, which I would not recommend, because if you try to fix something you can't fix, you'll just ruin it. Like, you can find all sorts of undergraduates who are perfectly willing to restructure the international economic system who cannot keep their room clean. And there's actually a gap there, you know, which, and it's surprising that people don't actually notice. So I would say, if you pay attention, you can see things that you could fix. They yell at you. They really do. We even know how that happens. Let me give you an example, because rooms are full of stories. And the stories have effects on you. So here's a classic experiment. So you take two groups of undergraduates, you bring them into your lab, and you give one group a multiple choice test that has a bunch of words in it that are associated with being old. And you give the other group the same multiple choice test, except the words are associated with being young. This is independent of the content of the test. It's just descriptions. And then you time the undergraduates as they walk back to the elevators. The ones who completed the multiple choice test that had more words associated with aging walk slower back to the elevators. And they don't know that. And they don't know they're doing it. And that study's been replicated in various forms many, many times. You're unbelievably sensitive to the story that your environment's telling you. Because your environment is not made out of objects. That's just wrong. Your environment is basically made out of something like tools and obstacles. You're a tool-using creature. You're a tool-perceiving creature. The things you... Like, if I take you out of this room and I say, well, what was in the room? You're not going to say, random patterns in the carpet, because they're real. They're just as good an object as anything else. You're going to say chairs because you can sit on them, and you're going to say handrails because you can hold them. You're going to say stairs because you can walk down them. That's what you see, and that's what you interact with. And if you pay attention to your environment, which is you, by the way, extended, all of your experience is you. It will tell you all the time what you should do. All you have to do is do it. But then you have to decide if you want to do it. One of the things I've noticed about people, because I've wondered, once I started studying these mythological stories, and I got this idea about the fact that life can be meaningful enough to justify its suffering, I thought, God, that's such a good idea. Because it's not optimistic exactly. You know, some people will tell you, well, you can be happy. It's like, those people are idiots. I'm telling you, they're idiots. There's going to be things that come along that flatten you so hard you won't believe it. And you're not happy then. And so if life is to be happy, well, in those situations, what are you doing? Why even live? But that isn't, life isn't to be happy. If you're happy, you're bloody fortunate, and you should enjoy it. You should, because it's the grace of God, so to speak. With regards to meaning, I thought, well, people know when they're doing something meaningful. They can tell. So why the hell don't they do meaningful things all the time? It seems obvious. You could do it. I mean, it's hard, you know, because other people want you to do other things. And it's a struggle, but everything's a struggle. And then I thought, well, oh, I get it. I see why. It took me about 10 years to figure this out. People have a choice. Choice number one, nothing you do means anything. Well, that's kind of a drag, right? It's meaninglessness of life and all that, existential angst. You know, that's kind of a pain. But the upside of nothing that you do is meaningful is you don't have to do anything. You've got no responsibility. Now, you have to suffer because things are meaningless, but that's a small price to pay for being able to be completely useless. The alternative is everything you do matters. Really. If you make a mistake, it's a real mistake. If you betray someone, you tilt the world a little more sharply towards evil rather than good. It matters what you do. Well, if you buy that, then you can have a meaningful life. But there's no mucking around. It means responsibility. It means that the decisions you make are important. It means that when you do something wrong, it's wrong. Well, do you want that? There's this idea in Jungian psychology called the circumambulation. And Jung had this idea that you had a potential future self, which would be in potential, everything that you could be. And that it manifests itself moment to moment in your present life by making you interested in things. And the things that you're interested in are the things that would guide you along the path that would lead you to maximal development. Now, it sounds like a metaphysical idea or a mystical idea even, but it's not. It's not. It's a really profoundly biological idea. The idea is something like, well, you're set up so that you're automatically interested in those things that would fully expand you as a well-adapted creature. Well, like, there's nothing radical about that idea. What else could possibly be the case? Unless there's something fundamentally flawed about you, that is what the situation would be. It's kind of interesting to think about how that would be manifest moment to moment, but the idea is something like, well, your interest is captured by those things that lead you down the path of development. Well, that better be the case. Okay, so that's fine. And so there's some utility in pursuing those things that you're interested in. That's the call to adventure, let's say. So, and the call to adventure takes you all sorts of places. Now, the problem with the call to adventure is, like, what the hell do you know? You might be interested in things that are kind of warped and bent. And often it's the case that when new parts of people manifest themselves and grip their interests, say, they do it very badly and shoddily. And so you stumble around like an idiot when you try to do something new. That's why the fool is the precursor to the savior from the symbolic perspectives, because you have to be a fool before you can be a master. And if you're not willing to be a fool, then you can't be a master. So you're going to... It's an error, error-ridden process. And that's also laid out in the Old Testament stories, because the first thing that happens to all these patriarchal figures when God kicks them out of their father's house when they're like 84 is that they run into all sorts of trouble, and some of it's social and some of it's natural and some of it's a consequence of their own moral inadequacy. So they're fools. But the thing that's so interesting is that despite the fact that they're fools, they're still supposed to go on the adventure. and that they're capable of learning enough as a consequence of moving forward on the adventure so that they straighten themselves out across time. And so it's something like this. So this circumambulation that Jung talked about was this continual, we'll return to this, this continual circling in some sense of who you could be. You might notice, for example, that there are themes in your life. You know, when you go back across your experiences, you see you kind of have your typical experience that sort of repeats itself. And there might be variation on it, like a musical theme, but it's like you're circling yourself and getting closer to yourself as you move across time. That's the circumambulation. Now, you remember that for a sec, because we'll go back to it. Okay, so imagine that something glimmers before you. It's an interest that's dawning, and you decide, well, first of all, you're paralyzed. You think, well, how do I know if I should pursue that? It's probably a stupid idea. And the proper response to that is, you're right, it probably is a stupid idea, because almost all ideas are stupid. And so the probability that as you move forward on your adventure that you're going to get it right the first time is zero. It's just not going to happen. And so then you might think, well, maybe I'll just wait around until I get the right idea, and which people do, right? So they're like 40-year-old, 13-year-olds, which is not a good idea. And so they wait around until it's waiting for Godot, until they finally got it right. But the problem is you're too stupid to know when you've got it right. So waiting around isn't going to help, because even if the perfect opportunity manifested itself to you in your incomplete form, the probability that you would recognize it as the perfect opportunity is zero. You might even think it's the worst possible idea that you've ever heard of anywhere. Highly likely. Highly likely. So you have, there's, Nietzsche called that a will to stupidity, which I really liked. So, because he thought of stupidity as being, it's you have to take it into account fundamentally and work with it. And so you can take these tentative steps on your pathway to destiny, and you can assume that you're going to do it badly. And that's really useful, because you don't have to beat yourself up. It's pretty easy to do it badly. But the thing is, it's way better to do it badly than not to do it at all. And that's a continual message that echoes through these historical stories in Genesis. It's like, these are flawed people. They should have got the hell out of their house way before they did. And they go out and they stumble around in tyranny and famine and self-betrayal and violence. But it's a hell of a lot better than just rotting away at home. And that's great. So that's good. And so why is that? Well, okay, so you start your path and you think that you're heading, you know, towards your star. And so you go in that direction. And then, because you're here, the world looks a particular way. But then when you move here, the world looks different. And you're different as a consequence of having made that voyage. And so what that means is that now that thing that glimmers in front of you is going to have shifted its location, because you weren't very good at specifying it to begin with, and now that you're a little sharper and more focused than you were, it's going to reveal itself with more accuracy to you. And so then you have to take it's almost like a 180-degree reversal. But it isn't, because, you've gone this far, and that's a long ways to get that far. But that's a lot farther than you would be if you just stayed where you were waiting. And so it doesn't matter that you overshoot continually, because as you overshoot, even if you don't learn what you should have done, you're going to continually learn what you shouldn't keep doing. And if you learn enough about what you shouldn't keep doing, then that's tantamount at some point to learning at the same time what you should be doing. So it's okay. So it's like this. Now, what's cool about it, though, I think, is that as you progress, the degree of overshooting starts to decline, right? And that we know that there's nothing hypothetical about that. As you learn a new skill, like even to play a song on the piano, for example, you overshoot madly. You're making all sorts of mistakes to begin with, and then the mistakes, they disappear. There's a great TED Talk, I think it was, about this guy set up a really advanced computational recording system in his home and recorded every single utterance his young child made while learning to speak. And then he put together the child's attempts to say certain phonemes and put them in the list, and you can hear the child deviating madly to begin with, and then after hundreds and hundreds of repetitions, just zeroing right in on the exact phoneme. So, you know, you might not know this, but when kids babble, because they start babbling when they're quite young, they babble every human phoneme, including all sorts of phonemes that adults can't say. And then they die into their language, so that after they learn, say, English, then there's all sorts of phonemes they can no longer hear or pronounce. But to begin with, it's all there, which is really quite interesting. But so as they learn a particular language, they zero in on the proper way to pronounce that, and their errors minimize. And every time you learn something, that's how it is. And that's really useful to know, too, because it means that it's okay to wander around stupidly before you fix your destination. Now, you see that echoed in Exodus, right? Because what happens is that the Egyptians, or the Hebrews, escape a tyranny, which is kind of whatever you do personally and psychologically when you escape from your previous set of stupidly held and ignorant and stubborn axioms. It's like, away from that tyranny. It's like, great, I freed myself from that. Well, then what? Well, you think, well, now I'm on the way. It's, no, you're not. Now you're in the desert where you wander around stupidly, you know, and worship the wrong things, until you finally organize yourself morally again and head in the proper direction. So that's worth knowing too, because you think, well, I got rid of a lot of things, baggage, excess baggage that I didn't need in my life, and now everything's okay. It's like, no, it's not. You've got rid of a whole set of scaffolds that were keeping you in place, even though they were pathological. Now you have nothing, and nothing actually turns out to be better than something pathological, but you're still stuck with the problem of nothing. And that's, well, that's exactly why Exodus is structured the way that it is. It's that you escape from a tyranny. It's, hooray, we're no longer slaves. Yeah, well, now you're nihilistic and lost. It's not necessarily an improvement. It's also useful to know that, because you can also be deluded into the idea that, imagine that you're trying to become enlightened, which might mean to turn all those parts of you on that could be turned on. You think, well, that's just a linear pathway uphill. You know, it's just from one success to another. No, it's not. It's like, here you are, and you're not doing too badly, and the first step is a complete bloody catastrophe. It's worse. And then maybe you can pull yourself together, and you hit a new plateau, and then that crumbles and shakes, and bang, it's worse again. And so, because part of the reason that people don't become enlightened is because it's punctuated by intermittent deserts, essentially, by intermittent catastrophes. And if you don't know that, well, then you're basically screwed, because you go ahead on your movement forward and you collapse and you think, well, that didn't work, I collapsed. It's like, no, that's par for the course. It's not indication that you failed, it's just indication that it's really hard. And that when you learn something, you also unlearn something. And the thing you unlearned is probably useful, and unlearning it actually is painful. You know, let's say if you have to get out of a bad relationship, it's like there isn't any relationship that's 100% bad. And so when you jump out of it, well, maybe you're in better shape, but you're still lonesome and disoriented, and you don't know what your past was, and you don't know what your present is, and you don't know what your future is. That's why people stay with the devil they know instead of, you know, looking for the devil they don't know. So anyways, the fact that you're full of faults doesn't mean you have to stop. And thank God for that. That's a really useful thing. And the fact that you're full of faults doesn't mean that you can't learn. And so you can posit an ideal, and you're going to be wrong about it, but it doesn't matter, because what you're right about is positing the ideal and moving towards it. If the actual ideal isn't conceptualized perfectly, well, first, surprise, surprise, because, like, what are you going to do that's perfect? So it doesn't matter that it's imperfect. It just matters that you do it and that you move forward. So that's really positive news as far as I'm concerned, because you can actually do that, right? You can do it badly. Anyone can do that. So that's useful. Okay, so like if you were an efficient person, you would have just done that. But you're not. But who cares? You know, you still end up in the same place. And maybe the trip is even more interesting. Who knows? Probably too interesting. The next best predictor of lifetime success is conscientiousness. Well, so, and of the two aspects of conscientiousness, say, orderliness and industriousness, the better predictor is industriousness. So the question is, well, what can you do about your industriousness? And the answer to that is, Well, that's kind of rough too, because there's a strong genetic component. But you can work on micro habits with regards to your conscientiousness. And I think the best micro habits, this is partly to do with this future authoring program processes, I think the best thing you can do with regards to your conscientiousness is to set up some aims for yourself, goals that you actually value. And the future authoring program helps people do that. And basically, it does a situational analysis of, it helps you do a situational analysis of your life more than a psychological analysis, I would say. And so the questions are something like, well, all right, you're going to have to put some effort into your life. And you need to be motivated to do that. And so what are the potential sources of motivation? Well, you could think about them in the big five manner. You know, if you're extroverted, you want friends. If you're agreeable, you want an intimate relationship. If you're disagreeable, you want to win competitions. If you're open, you want to engage in creative activity. If you're high neuroticism, you want security. Okay, so those are all sources of potential motivation that you could draw on, that you could tailor to your own, you know, your own personality. But then there are dimensions that you want to consider your life across. And so we ask people about, well, you know, if you could have your life the way you wanted it in 3 to 5 years, if you were taking care of yourself properly, you know, what would you want from your friendships? What would you want from your intimate relationship? How would you like to structure your family? What do you want for your career? Well, how are you going to use your time outside of your job? And how are you going to regulate your mental and physical health, and maybe also your drug and alcohol use? Because that's a good place to auger down, you know, because alcoholism, for example, wipes out, you know, 5 to 10% of people. So you want to keep that under control. And then so maybe, you know, you develop a vision of what you would like your life to be, and that associates the goal. Once the goal is established, and then you break down the goal into micro processes that you can implement, the micro processes become rewarding in proportion, in relation to their causal association with the goal. And that tangles in your incentive reward system. You know, we talked about the dopaminergic incentive reward system, and that's the thing that keeps you moving forward. And the way it works is that it works better if it produces positive emotion when it can see you moving towards a valued goal. Okay, well, what's the implication of that? Better have a valued goal, because otherwise you can't get any positive motivation working out. And so the more valuable the goal, in principle, the more the micro processes associated with that goal start to take on a positive charge. And so what that means is, well, you get up in the morning and you're excited about the day, you're ready to go. And so as far as I can tell, what you do is you specify your long-term ideal. Maybe you also specify a place you want to stay the hell away from, so that you're terrified to fail as well as excited about succeeding, because that's also useful. You specify your goal. You do that in some sense as a unique individual. You want to specify goals that make you say, oh, if that could happen as a consequence of my efforts, it would clearly be worthwhile. Because the question always is, why do something? Because doing nothing is easy. You just sit there and you don't do anything. That's real easy. The question is, why would you ever do anything? And the answer to that has to be because you've determined by some means that it's worthwhile. And then the next question might be, well, where should you look for worthwhile things? And one would be, well, you could consult your own temperament. And the other would be, well, you kind of look at what it is that people accrue that's valuable across the lifespan. So you do a structural analysis of the subcomponents of human existence, and I already did that. You need a family, you need friends. Like, you don't need to have all these things, but you better have most of them. Family, friends, career, educational goals, plans for, you know, time outside of work, attention to your mental and physical health, etc. You know, that's what life is about. And if you don't have any of those things, well, then all you've got left is misery and suffering. So that's a bad deal for you. So once you set up that goal structure, let's say, and that's really in many ways that's what you should be doing at university. That's exactly what you should be doing, is trying to figure out who it is that you're trying to be, right? And you aim at that, and then you use everything you learn as a means of building that person that you want to be. And I really mean want to be. I don't mean should be, even those things are going to overlap. And it's important to distinguish between those, because that's partly, and this is back down to the micro routine analysis. So if I was saying, well, you're going to try to make yourself more industrious. Okay, number one, specify your damn goals, because how are you going to hit something if you don't know what it is? That isn't going to happen. And often people won't specify their goals too, because they don't like to specify conditions for failure. So if you keep yourself all vague and foggy, which is real easy, because that's just a matter of not doing as well, then you don't know when you fail. And people might say, well, I really don't want to know when I fail, because that's painful. So I'll keep myself blind about when I fail. That's fine, except you'll fail all the time then. You just won't know it until you've failed so badly that you're done. And that can easily happen by the time you're 40. So I would recommend that you don't let that happen. So that's willful blindness, right? You could have known, but you chose not to. Okay, so once you get your goal structure set up, you think, okay, if I could have this life, looks like that might be worth living, despite the fact that it's going to be, you know, anxiety provoking and threatening, and there's going to be some suffering and loss involved and all of that. Obviously, the goal is to have a vision for your life such that, all things considered, that justifies your effort. Okay, so then what do? Well, then you turn down to the micro routines. It's like, okay, well, this is what I'm aiming for. How does that instantiate itself day to day, week to week, month to month? And that's where something like a schedule can be unbelievably useful. Google Calendar. It's like, make a damn schedule and stick to it. Okay, so what's the rule with a schedule? It's not a bloody prison. That's the first thing that people do wrong. They say, well, I don't like to follow a schedule. Well, it's like, well, what kind of schedule are you setting up? Well, I have to do this, then I have to do this, then I have to do this, you know, and then I just go play video games, because who wants to do all these things that I have to do? It's like, wrong. Set the damn schedule up so that you have the day you want. That's the trick. It's like, okay, I've got tomorrow. If I was going to set it up so it was the best possible day I could have, practically speaking, what would it look like? Well, then you schedule that. And obviously, there's a bit of responsibility that's going to go along with that, because if you have any sense, one of the things that you're going to insist upon is that at the end of the day, you're not in worse shape than you were than at the beginning of the day, right? Because that's a stupid day. If you have a bunch of those in a row, you just dig, you know, you dig yourself a hole and then you bury yourself in it. It's like, sorry, that's just not a good strategy. It's a bad strategy. So maybe 20% of your day has to be responsibility and obligation, or maybe it's more than that, depending on how far behind you are. But even that, you can ask yourself, okay, well, I've got these responsibilities. I have to schedule the damn things in. What's the right ratio of responsibility to reward? And you can ask yourself that, just like you'd negotiate with someone who is working for you. It's like, okay, you got to work tomorrow. Okay, so I want you to work tomorrow. And you might say, okay, well, what are you going to do for me that makes it likely that I'll work for you? Well, you could ask yourself that, you know. So maybe you do an hour of responsibility and then you play a video game for 15 minutes. I don't know, whatever turns your crank, man. But, you know, you have to negotiate with yourself and not tyrannize yourself like you're negotiating with someone that you care for, that you would like to be productive and have a good life. And that's how you make the schedule. It's like, and then you look at the day and you think, well, if I had that day, that'd be good. Great. You know, and you're useless and horrible, so you'll probably only hit it with about 70% accuracy, but that beats the hell out of zero, right? And if you hit it even with 50% accuracy, another rule is, well, aim for 51% the next week, or 50.5% for God's sake, or because you're going to hit that position where things start to loop back positively and spiral you upward. And so that's one way that you can work on your conscientiousness, is plan a life you'd like to have. And you do that partly by referring to social norms. That's more or less rescuing your father from the belly of the whale. But the other way you do that is by having a little conversation with yourself about, as if you don't really know who you are, because you know what you're like. You won't do what you're told. You won't do what you tell yourself to do. You must have noticed that. It's like you're a bad employee and a worse boss, and both of those work, you know, for you. You don't know what you want to do, and then when you tell yourself what to do, you don't do it anyways. You should fire yourself and find someone else to be. But you know, my point is that you have to understand that you're not your own servant, so to speak. You're someone that you have to negotiate with, and you're someone that you want to present the opportunity of having a good life to. And that's hard for people, because they don't like themselves very much. So, you know, they're always like cracking the whip and then procrastinating, and cracking the whip and then procrastinating. And it's like, God, it's so boring and such a pathetic way of spending your time. And you know what that's like, because you probably waste like 6 hours a day. And I think we did an economic calculation about that a while back, right? Your time's probably worth $50 an hour, something like that. I mean, you're not getting paid that now, but you're young, and so this is investment time, and what you do now is going to multiply its effects in the future. So let's say it's $50 an hour, which is perfectly reasonable. So if you waste 6 hours a day, and you are, then you're wasting about $2,000 a week or about $100,000 a year. So like, go ahead, but that's what it's costing you every hour. And you need to know what your damn time is worth.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1. For over 60 years, we've helped millions of members find what works for them. Now, it's your turn. Weight Watchers, watch it work. Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s.
Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects.
With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last. Get started today for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com.
So let's say it's not $50, it's $30. Whatever, maybe it's 100, it's somewhere in that range. One of the things you should be asking yourself is, when you spend an hour, was that, well, would have I paid someone $50 to have had that hour? And if the answer is no, it's like, well, maybe you should do something else with your time. And it depends on whether or not you think that your time's worthwhile. But the funny thing about not assuming that is, if you assume your time isn't worthwhile, what happens is you don't just sit around sort of randomly in a state of responsibility-less bliss. What you do is you suffer existentially. And so that seems like a stupid solution. Okay, now down to cognitive ability. Well, how can you conceptualize intelligence? Well, this is a major problem because your initial conceptualization determines in part the strategies that you're going to use to investigate intelligence. And when you say... When you pare a sentence down to what is intelligence, the sentence is problematic because part of it is a question about if and how such a thing might manifest itself in the world. So there's a fact out there that, or a set of facts that corresponds to intelligence, but the other problem is, well, what do you mean when you say intelligence? And you kind of have to nail that down if you're going to have a conversation about intelligence that doesn't go entirely astray. And so you've got a definitional problem as well as an empirical problem. And so there have been, and this was especially true in the 1990s, people have been studying intelligence, IQ intelligence, since the 1920s. And it is a very well-established branch of psychology. One of the things I have to tell you about IQ research is that if you don't buy IQ research, you might as well throw away all the rest of psychology. And the reason for that is that the psychologists, first of all, who developed intelligence testing were among the early psychologists who instantiated the statistical techniques that all psychologists use to verify and test all of their hypotheses. So you end up throwing the baby out with the bathwater. And the IQ people have defined intelligence in a more stringent and accurate way than we've been able to define almost any other psychological construct. And so if you toss out the one that's most well-defined, then you're kind of stuck with the problem of what are you going to do with all the ones that you have left over that are nowhere near as well-defined or as well-measured or whose predictive validity is much less and has been demonstrated with much less vigor and clarity. Anyways, despite all that, People have posited a number of different intelligences, and reasonably so, because there's a, if you think of intelligence as that which might move you forward successfully in the world, obviously there's a fair number of phenomena that are associated with individuals that might fit into that category. So we have people have made these distinctions. Bob Sternberg, for example, has distinguished between practical versus analytical intelligence, and he kind of thinks of practical as like street smarts and has attempted to dissociate that from the kind of analytical intelligence that that characterizes more straight IQ research. I don't think he's done it successfully as well at all, and since the 1990s, interest in his practical intelligence has declined precipitously, because when it is matched head-to-head with standard IQ intelligence, the IQ intelligence eats up all the variability. What's really happened, as far as I can tell so far, is that when we're trying to predict people's course through life, IQ does a very good job, and then one of the traits does a very good job as well, which is conscientiousness. But it doesn't do as good a job as IQ. Now, that partly might be because we can't measure conscientiousness very well. We're stuck with self-reports, or maybe I could gather peer reports about you, or I could gather your parents' reports about you, or teachers' reports, and each of those seems to pick up a little bit more of the pattern, because you know yourself, but other people know you differently than you know yourself, and there's still some accuracy in that. You can get multiple rater reports of something like conscientiousness, and that'll up its predictive validity. But in the final analysis, the best you seem to be able to do with conscientiousness is about a 0.4 correlation with long-term performance, whereas with IQ, in complex jobs, you can probably get 0.5 and maybe 0.6. And so 0.5 is 25% of the variance. You got to square it. 0.6 is 30%. 36% of the variance, and 0.4 is 16% of the variance. So even at the low end, let's say high end for conscientiousness is 0.4 or 16%, low end for IQ is 0.5 or 25%. Low end estimates of IQ make it 1.5 times more powerful than the high end estimates of conscientiousness. And I think that's about right. You'd think, why do we even have to debate this? And because it's so bloody obvious to me that intelligence is a major predictor of life success. I mean, you people, I measured the IQ of University of Toronto people. You know, people in this room who have an IQ of less than 120 are rare. Well, why? Well, smart people go to university. Now, is that actually a contentious statement? Well, it shouldn't be a contentious statement. It's self-evident. Universities were actually set up so that smart people could expand their abilities. That's why they were there. And you're selected on the basis of assessments that are essentially there to assess something like intelligence.
Maybe what the controversy is that whatever they're measuring, they're measuring something. So being able to perform those puzzles.
Yes, but that is part of the controversy. Is it reasonable? And this is a measurement issue. And that's why I've been instructing you to some degree in psychometrics, because we actually know how to do this. We know how to answer that question. So let's take a look at how intelligence has been assessed and why, and then you can make up your own mind. Anyways, here's some of the examples of other forms of intelligence. And so then the question is, well, what does it mean to have a different form of intelligence? Would form A and form B be completely uncorrelated? Like extroversion, say, in neuroticism, or would they be slightly correlated, or would they be highly correlated? And then you might ask, well, how highly correlated do they have to be before they're the same thing? Or how uncorrelated do they have to be before they're different things? And actually, the answer to that comes down to something like practical utility. It's like, imagine I'm trying to figure out how well you'll do in university, and I measure one thing, and it's correlated at 0.7 with another thing I measure about you. Then I might say, well, are those two things the same or different? They're pretty highly correlated. You're high in one, it means you're going to be high in the other. Well, so what is there any utility in measuring both things? And the way you figure that out, actually, is you do it statistically. So we take the target, which might be your performance across university, and then we say, well, can we predict your performance across university better by using one variable or two variables? So we would enter them both into a regression equation. All a regression equation does, it's quite simple. So you're trying to predict a target, and the regression equation tells you how well you can predict that target if you know another fact. Now then it gets a little complicated, because that's a correlation. How well you can predict B with A. Well, a regression will say how much you can predict C if you know A and B, or A and B and C and D and E, because you can use multiple predictors, and you can weight them. So it might be 2 times A plus 1 times B equals C. And that's all a regression equation does. It's just multiplication and addition. Very, very straightforward. And so 2 variables are sufficiently different functionally if you can use both of them simultaneously to predict something of interest. So again, it's a tool-like approach. This is how the psychometricians do it. Is something real? Well, it's real if you can measure it and it helps you predict. That's how it's defined. So then you might say, well, are there these multiple intelligences? Well, the first question would be, well, what do you mean by are there? And the answer to that would be, well, let's specify the question, since we're going to be scientific about it. Let's predict how well people do in university. We'll start with the assumption that intelligence, if intelligence isn't associated with university success, then you're probably not talking about intelligence. Now, you could argue that, right? Because you could say, well, intelligence has nothing to do with university success. But that's a definitional matter. We'd have to agree to begin with. Is it reasonable to start with the presupposition that intelligence and university success share something in common? Well, I think you have to be daft to deny that initial proposition, although you could. Because you could say it was privilege or socioeconomic status or any number of sociological phenomena, and some of those are obviously relevant. Social class, for example. Because, you know, if you're in a higher social class, and all things being equal, intelligence included, if you're in a higher social class, you're more likely to go to university than you are if you're in a lower social class. So there's other factors that are going to influence whether or not you do well in university. But we're going to assume that one of them might be intelligence. Well, then you would ask, well, if you measured social intelligence, so that's, what do they call that? Social intelligence? No, emotional intelligence, which does not exist, by the way. Emotional intelligence, moral intelligence, linguistic, musical, logical, mathematical, spatial, body kinesthetic, interpersonal, and interpersonal. All different forms of intelligence. Okay, so to answer the question of whether they exist, what you do first is pick a target, prediction of university performance. Then you make a measure for each of them. Then you test to see if the measure measured the same thing across multiple instances within the same person. That's a reliability test, because what the hell good is your ruler if it stretches when you use it? It has to measure the same thing multiple times. And then you would say, okay, we'll take all these different intelligences measured the way we've decided to measure them. The first thing we'll do is see how highly correlated they are, because if they're complete, two of them are completely correlated, then you have one. You don't have two, because that's virtually the definition of one instead of two. You can factor analyze them and see if you can pull out what's common across all of them. That's another thing, because then you might say, well, intelligence is what's common across all the measures of these intelligences. It's a proposition. It's not a fact. You have to decide if you're going to agree with it. But that, if you were going to do that, you'd use a factor analysis. You'd say, well, if someone was more likely to be musical, if they were also high in linguistic ability, and more likely to be logical and mathematically inclined if they had high spatial ability, etc., then you'd be hypothesizing that there was one factor behind all of those manifestations that's somehow similar. And maybe there wouldn't be. And then you'd take all your measures and you'd put them in something like a multiple regression analysis, and you'd predict your target, university performance. And then maybe you'd say, well, wait a minute, let's not just use university performance. Let's use junior high performance, high school performance, university performance, and job success. And then let's say that only things that predict success across all of those categories and that are the same we're going to define as intelligence. Well, that's basically how you end up with IQ. You could say that IQ is what's common across all possible sets of intelligence tests. Now, people are going to debate that, because you still have to define what constitutes a test. But the way the psychometricians have managed it and have taken care of this, at least to some degree, is to say, well, we're not going to define everything that we measure as intelligence. So extroverted people are more socially fluent. Are we going to call that intelligence? No. We're going to call that personality. We're going to call that extroversion. And we're going to call stress tolerance. You could say, well, if you can tolerate more stress, you're more intelligent. It's like, well, no, that isn't how we've defined it. We're going to define that as being lower in neuroticism. If you're cooperative, you're more intelligent. That's emotional intelligence. Well, what? You're less intelligent if you're competitive? Well, no. So we've parsed that off to agreeableness. So then the question might be, is there anything left of these so-called intelligences once you control for personality and IQ? And the answer is no. Nothing. Nothing left of them. And the people who keep pushing these ideas keep trying to push them because they don't like the idea of real individual differences. And to me, that's just a matter of sticking your damn head in the sand, because it's obvious. Here, you're going to have a child. You want the child to have an IQ of 65 or 145. Decide. Okay, so you're all going to vote. Okay, you think any one of you is going to vote to have a child with an IQ of 65? That child's going to have a hard time developing even linguistic ability. They're never going to learn to read, right? They're never going to leave home, in all likelihood. So which child are you going to pick? Well, so do you believe in intelligence or not? Well, obviously, if you have any sense. You know, if you take people, and I've told you this, and you expose them voluntarily to things that they are avoiding and are afraid of, you know, that they know they need to overcome in order to meet their goals, their self-defined goals. If you can teach people to stand up in the face of the things they're afraid of, they get stronger. And you don't know what the upper limits to that are, because you might ask yourself, like, if for 10 years, if you didn't avoid doing what you knew you needed to do, by your own definitions, right, within the value structure that you've created to the degree that you've done that, what would you be like? Well, you know, there are remarkable people who come into the world from time to time, and there are people who do find out over decades-long periods what they could be like if they were who they were, if they spoke their being forward. And they get stronger and stronger and stronger, and we don't know the limits to that. We do not know the limits to that. And so you could say, well, in part, perhaps the reason that you're suffering unbearably can be left at your feet, because you're not everything you could be, and you know it. And of course, that's a terrible thing to admit, and it's a terrible thing to consider, but there's real promise in it, right? Because it means that perhaps there's another way that you could look at the world and another way that you could act in the world. So what it would reflect back to you would be much better than what it reflects back to you now. And then the second part of that is, well, imagine that many people did that, because we've done a lot as human beings. We've done a lot of remarkable things. And I've told you already, I think before, that today, for example, about 250,000 people will be lifted out of abject poverty and about 300,000 people attached to the electrical power grid. We're lifting people out of poverty collectively at a faster rate that's ever occurred in the history of humankind by a huge margin. And that's been going on unbelievably quickly since the year 2000. The UN had planned to have poverty between 2000 and 2015, and it was accomplished by 2013. So there's inequality developing in many places, and you hear lots of political agitation about that. But overall, the tide is lifting everyone up, and that's a great thing. And we have no idea how fast we could multiply that if people got their act together and really aimed at it. Because, you know, my experience is with people that we're probably running at about 51% of our capacity. Something, I mean, you can think about this yourselves. I often ask undergraduates how many hours a day you waste or how many hours a week you waste. And the classic answer is something like 4 to 6 hours a day. You know, inefficient studying, watching things on YouTube that not only do you not want to watch, that you don't even care about, that make you feel horrible about watching after you're done, that's probably 4 hours right there. You know, you think, well, that's 20, 25 hours a week, it's 100 hours a month, that's 2.5 full work weeks, it's half a year of work weeks per year. And if your time is worth $20 an hour, which is a radical underestimate, it's probably more like 50 if you think about it in terms of deferred wages. If you're wasting 20 hours a week, you're wasting $50,000 a year. And you are doing that right now. And it's because you're young, wasting $50,000 a year is a way bigger catastrophe than it would be for me to waste it, because I'm not going to last nearly as long. And so if your life isn't everything it could be, you could ask yourself, well, what would happen if you just stopped wasting the opportunities that are in front of you? You'd be who knows how much more efficient, 10 times more efficient, 20 times more efficient. That's the Pareto distribution. You have no idea how efficient people get. It's completely, it's off the charts. Well, and if we all got our act together collectively and stopped making things worse, because that's another thing people do all the time, Not only do they not do what they should to make things better, they actively attempt to make things worse because they're spiteful or resentful or arrogant or deceitful or homicidal or genocidal or all of those things all bundled together in an absolutely pathological package. If people stopped really, really trying just to make things worse, we have no idea how much better they would get just because of that. So there's this weird dynamic that's part of the existential system of ideas between human vulnerability, social judgment, both of which are major causes of suffering, and the failure of individuals to adopt the responsibility that they know they should adopt. And that's the thing that's interesting too, is that, and like one of the, another thing I've often asked my undergraduate classes is, you know, there's this idea that, that people have a conscience. And you know what the conscience is, it's this feeling or voice you have in your head just before you do something that you know is stupid, telling you that probably you shouldn't do that stupid thing. You don't have to listen to it, strangely enough, but you go ahead and do it anyways, and then, of course, exactly what the conscience told you was going to happen inevitably happens so that you feel even stupider about it than you would if it happened by accident, because you know, I knew this was going to happen, I got a warning it was going to happen, and I went and did it anyways. And the funny thing, too, is that that conscience operates within people, and we really don't understand what the hell that is. So you might say, well, what would happen if you abided by your conscience for 5 years or for 10 years? What sort of position might you be in? What sort of family might you have? What sort of relationship might you be able to forge? And you can be bloody sure that a relationship that's forged on the basis of who you actually are is going to be a lot stronger and more welcome than one that's forged on the basis of who you aren't. Now, of course, that means that the person you're with has to deal with the full force of you in all your ability and your catastrophe, and that's a very, very difficult thing to negotiate. But if you do negotiate it, well, at least you have something, you have somewhere solid to stand, and you have somewhere to live, you have a real life, and it's a great basis upon which to bring children into the world, for example, because you can have an actual relationship with them instead of torturing them half to death, which is what happens in a tremendously large minority of cases. Well, it's more than that too, because, and this is what I'll close with, and this is why I wanted to introduce Solzhenitsyn's writings to you, you see, because it isn't merely that your fate depends on whether or not you get your act together and to what degree you decide that you're going to live out your own genuine being. It isn't only your fate. It's the fate of everyone that you're networked with. And so, you know, you think, well, there's 9 billion, 7 billion people in the world. We're going to peak at about 9 billion, by the way, and then it'll decline rapidly. But 7 billion people in the world, and who are you? You're just one little dust mote among that 7 billion, and so it really doesn't matter what you do or don't do, but that's simply not the case. It's the wrong model, because you're at the center of a network. You're a node in a network. Of course, that's even more true now that we have social media. You'll know 1,000 people, at least over the course of your life, and they'll know 1,000 people each, and that puts you one person away from a million, and two persons away from a billion. And so that's how you're connected, and the things you do, they're like dropping a stone in a pond. The ripples move outward, and they affect things in ways that you can't fully comprehend. And it means that the things that you do and that you don't do are far more important than you think. And so if you act that way, of course, the terror of realizing that is that it actually starts to matter what you do. And you might say, well, that's better than living a meaningless existence. It's better for it to matter. But I mean, if you really asked yourself, would you be so sure if you had the choice? I can live with no responsibility whatsoever. The price I pay is that nothing matters. Or I can reverse it and everything matters. But I have to take the responsibility that's associated with that. It's not so obvious to me that people would take the meaningful path. Now, when you say, well, nihilists suffer dreadfully because there's no meaning in their life and they still suffer. Yeah, but the advantage is they have no responsibility. So that's the payoff, and I actually think that's the motivation. Say, well, I can't help being nihilistic. All my belief systems have collapsed. It's like, yeah, maybe. Maybe you've just allowed them to collapse because it's a hell of a lot easier than acting them out. And the price you pay is some meaningless suffering, but you can always whine about that and people will feel sorry for you, and you have the option of taking the pathway of the martyr. So that's a pretty good deal, all things considered, especially when the alternative is to bear your burden properly and to live forthrightly in the world. Well, what Solzhenitsyn figured out, and so many people in the 20th century, it's not just him, even though he's the best example, is that if you live a pathological life, you pathologize your society. And if enough people do that, then it's hell. Really. Really. And you can read the Gulag Archipelago if you have the fortitude to do that, and you'll see exactly what hell is like. And then you can decide if that's a place you'd like to visit, or even more importantly, if it's a place you'd like to visit and take all your family and friends. Because that's what happened in the 20th century. We're having a conversation. I'm deciding I'm going to listen to you. Right? That's different than how people generally communicate, because usually when they communicate, they're doing something like, okay, we're going to have a conversation, and I'm going to tell you why I'm right, and I'll win if you agree. Or maybe you're having a conversation where, I don't know what you're trying to do, maybe you're trying to impress the person you're talking to, so you're not listening to them at all, you're just thinking about what you're going to say next. Okay, so that's not this. This is, you might have something to tell me. And so I'm going to listen on the off chance that you'll tell me something that would really be useful for me to know. And so you could think about it as an extension of the Piagetian, you know, Piaget talked about the fundamentally important element of knowledge being to describe how knowledge is sought, the process by which knowledge is generated. Well, if you agree with me and I find that out, I know nothing more than I knew before. I just know what I knew before. And maybe I'm happy about that because, you know, it didn't get challenged. But I'm no smarter than I was before. But maybe you're different than me. And so while I'm listening to you, you'll tell me something I don't like. Maybe it's something I find contemptible or difficult, whatever. Maybe you'll tell me something I don't know. And then I won't be quite as stupid. And then maybe I won't run painfully into quite as many things. And that's a really useful thing to know, especially if you live with someone and you're trying to make long-term peace with them, is they're not the same as you. And their way they look at the world and the facts that they pull out of the world aren't the same as your facts. And even though you're going to be overwhelmed with the proclivity to demonstrate that you're right, it is the case that two brains are better than one. And so maybe 9 of the 10 things they tell you are dispensable, or maybe even 49 out of 50, but one thing. All you need to get out of the damn conversation is one thing you don't know. And one of the things that's very cool about a good psychotherapeutic session is that the whole conversation is like that. All you're doing is trying to express the truth of the situation as clearly as possible. That's it. And so, now, Roger's proposition, and I'll tell you why he derived it, was that if you have a conversation like that with someone, it will make both of you better. It'll make both of you psychologically healthier. So there's an implicit presupposition that the exchange of truth is curative. Well, that's a very cool idea. I mean, it's a very deep idea. I think it's the most profound idea. It's the idea upon which Western civilization, although not only Western civilization, is actually predicated. The idea that truth produces health. But for Rogers, that was the entire purpose of the psychotherapeutic alliance. You come to see me because you want to be better. You don't even know what that means necessarily, neither do I. We're going to figure that out together. But you come and you say, look, things are not acceptable to me, and maybe there's something I could do about that. So that's the minimal precondition to engage in therapy. Something's wrong, you're willing to talk about it truthfully, and you want it to be better. Without that, the therapeutic relationship does not get off the ground. And so then you might ask, well, what relationships are therapeutic? And the answer to that would be, if you have a real relationship, it's therapeutic. If it isn't, what you have is not a relationship. God only knows what you have. You're a slave, they're a tyrant, you know, you're both butting heads with one another. It's a primate dominance hierarchy dispute. Oh, I don't know, you're like two cats in a barrel or two people with their hands around each other's throats. But what you have is not a relationship. So, all right. We may say that the greater the communicated congruence of experience, awareness, and behavior on the part of one individual, that's a reference to the same idea that I was describing with regards to Jung. So, let's say you come and talk to me and you want things to go well. Well, I'm going to have to more or less be one thing. Because if I'm all over the place, you can't trust any continuity in what I say. There's no reason for you to believe that I'm capable of actually telling you, I'm capable of expressing anything that's true. So the truth is something that emerges as a consequence of getting yourself lined up and beating all the, what would you call, all the impurities out of your soul, for lack of a better word. You have to be integrated for that to happen, and you do that at least in part by wanting to tell the truth. The more the ensuing relationship will involve a tendency towards reciprocal communication with the same qualities. So one of the things, well, I've been quite influenced by Rogers, one of the things I try to do in my therapeutic sessions is first of all to listen, to really listen. And then while I listen, I watch, and while I'm listening, things will happen in my head. You know, maybe I'll get a little image of something, or I'll get a thought or a question will emerge, and then I'll just tell the person what that is. But it's sort of directionless, you know. It's not like I have a goal, except that we're trying to make things better. I'm on the side of the person, I'm on the side of the part of the person that wants things to be better, not worse. And so then those parts of us have a dialogue, and the consequence of that dialogue is that certain things take place, and then I'll just tell the person what happened. And it isn't that I'm right. That's not the point. The point is that they get to have an hour where someone actually tells them what they think. Here's the impact you're having on me. You know, this is making me angry. This is making me happy. This is really interesting. This reminds me of something that you said an hour ago that I don't quite understand. And the whole point is not for either person to make the proposition or convince the other that their position is correct, but merely to have an exchange of experience about how things are set up. And it's extraordinarily useful for people, because it's often difficult for anyone to find anyone to talk to that will actually listen. And so another thing that's really strange about this listening is that if you listen to people, they will tell you the weirdest bloody things so fast you just cannot believe it. So if you're having a conversation with someone and it's dull, it's because you're stupid. That's why. You're not listening to them properly, because they're weird. They're like wombats or albatrosses or rhinoceroses or something. Like, they're strange creatures. And so if you were actually communicating with them and they were telling you how weird they really are, it would be anything but boring. So, and you can ask questions. That's a really good way of listening. But, you know, one of Roger's points is, well, you have to be oriented properly in order to listen. And the orientation has to be, look, what I want out of this conversation is that the place we both end up is better than the place we left. That's it. That's what I'm after. And if you're not after that, you got to think, why the hell wouldn't you be after that? What could you possibly be after that would be better than that? You walk away smarter and more well-equipped for the world than you were before you had the conversation, and so does the other person. Well, maybe if you're bitter and resentful and angry and anxious and, you know, generally annoyed at the world, then that isn't what you want. You want the other person to walk away worse, and you too, because you're full of revenge. But, you know, you'll get what you want if you do that. So we know from our research that such empathic understanding, it's already defined that. I want to hear you. I want to hear what you have to say so we can clarify it and move forward. I want to have your best interests in mind, and mine as well, but, you know, both at the same time. Your families too, if we can manage that. We're after making things better. We know from our research that such empathic understanding with a person, not about them, is such an effective approach that it can bring about major changes in personality. Some of you may be feeling that you listen well to people and that you have never seen such results. The chances are very great that you have not been listening in the manner that I've described. Fortunately, I can suggest a little experiment that you can do to test the quality of your understanding. The next time you get into an argument with your wife or your friend or a small group of friends, stop the discussion for a moment and, for an experiment, institute this rule. Each person can speak up for himself only after he has first restated the ideas and feelings of the previous speaker accurately. What accurately means is they have to agree with your restatement. Now, that's an annoying thing to do, because if someone is talking to you and you disagree with them, the first thing you want to do is take their argument, make the stupidest possible thing out of it that you can, that's the straw man, and then demolish it. It's like, so then you can walk away feeling good about it, and, you know, you primate dominated them really nicely. So But that isn't what you do. You say, okay, well, I'm going to take what you told me, and maybe I'm even going to make your argument stronger than the one you made. That's useful if you're dealing with someone that you have to live with, because maybe they can't bloody well express themselves very well, but they have something to say. So you make their argument strong. All right, then, you see what this would mean. It would mean that before presenting your own point of view, it would be necessary for you to really achieve the other speaker's frame of reference, to understand his thoughts and feelings so well that you could summarize them for him. Sounds simple, doesn't it? But if you will try it, you'll find that it's the most difficult thing that you've ever done.